And now joining us via phone from Boston is Matt Bartolini, head of Spider America's research at State Street Global Advisors. Of course, State Street is currently the third largest ETF provider in the country. They offer over 140 ETFs with about $620 billion invested, including a suite of smart beta ETFs, which is what we'll be focusing on this week, specifically multi-factor ETFs. Matt, always great having you on the show.
Yeah, great to be back.
Matt, you know, anytime we talk smart beta, I always like to start with a few basics because this is an area I think some investors are still trying to wrap their heads around. So let's maybe just do a quick smart beta 101 before we get into multi-factor ETFs. How do you like to describe this space? What are some of the key points here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit it right off the bat, though. It's kind of a big tent. There's a lot of different definitions, and I think that really underscores a lot of the due diligence that's necessary within smart beta. There's a lot of different products, and just because they all fall under that one moniker, they're not all the same. And I think even the definitions can actually have a lot of differences, too. So when we think about it, it's really the combination of low costs and discipline typically found within passive investment management combined with that active management's potential for outperformance. So a very transparent, rules-based process that targets specific factors that have been shown to work well in academia to drive equity returns over a long life cycle. So whether that's size, value, quality, low volatility, momentum, or dividend yield. And the smart beta approach is to target them in a quantitative process that's very transparent and disciplined to potentially provide a performance stream that is above market returns or to drive a specific outcome like generating income.
Matt, I think most investors are familiar, obviously, with something like the S&P 500, which is market cap weighted. I'm just curious, does State Street consider smart beta, you know, sort of everything that is non-market cap weighted?
So, again, that sort of goes back to like the big tent and a lot of different opinions. You know, I think when you span across, you know, traditional data providers, whether it be Morningstar, FactSet, or Bloomberg, they actually all have different counts, security counts of what would be smart beta. They have different assets. And it's because there's really no one true, you know, one true North Star of categorization. We've tried to apply our own approach just to think about how investors might actually be using these products in their portfolios and how they do the due diligence themselves. So we don't include market cap weighted, with a caveat of that we include market cap weighted dividend strategies because that's a specific focus on a specific outcome. We ended up writing a blog post about this in the early part of the year. We found that, you know, while say Morningstar, which, you know, obviously a great data firm, they have about, you know, they've somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $700 billion of assets listed for smart beta. When we use our quantitative approach to carve out market cap weighted, we get down to around 350.
Okay, so we're going to focus in on multi-factor ETFs. This is one of the fastest growing areas within smart beta. An example here would be the Spider MSCI USA Strategic Factors ETF, ticker symbol QUS. Let me start with two questions here. One, what do you see as the advantages of using a multi-factor ETF versus just combining single factors on your own? Some of the factors you mentioned earlier, size, value, quality. And then two, what are the potential advantages of multi-factor ETFs versus just market cap weighting, right? Something like the S&P 500.
Yeah, so single factors like low volatility can be inherently cyclical. And you can mitigate the cyclicality of single factors by combining them together with other factor exposures that have either different correlations or different economic tendencies. So, for instance, again, value tends to be very early cycle. It has its higher performance in the early part of the economic cycle, while quality is typically more of a late cycle defensive type allocation. Now, both have shown long-term outperformance of traditional cap-weighted benchmarks. However, there have been periods, particularly for value more recently over the last, you know, 5 or 7 years, where there's been underperformance because of cyclical pressures. Combining strategies together can mitigate that cyclicality but still achieve long-term outperformance because of that, you know, blending of two low-correlated assets together.
Matt, when you talk about combining factors, you know, one of the things I've noticed in evaluating the growing number of multi-factor ETFs out there, some of these seem like they're just mixing together so many factors that I wonder if they sort of cancel each other out and the ETF just ends up looking like the S&P 500, except at a higher cost. Do you see that as an issue just in the space as a whole?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not really an issue, but I think it's something that, you know, fund sponsors and asset management firms should really lead on from an education perspective. I mean, hopefully your audience gets the Happy Gilmore joke, but, you know, three factors, four factors, green jacket, gold jacket. I think it all comes back to why you're actually combining the factors. What's the goal? Now, if you're going to combine all five factors together, great. What's my performance going to look like? What's my concentration? If it's meant to replace an active manager, a high active share active manager with high concentration risks without any sector biases, and you're going to do that with this five-factor approach, that's great. What does the holdings look like? What's the performance stream? Do you have a lot of tracking error? So it really, you know, whether it's two, four, five, or three in our case, what is the goal? What's the you know, result of combining these factor exposures, and how are you going to use it in portfolios? And I think that just is where we go from that sort of, you know, how many factors is enough factors discussion.
Matt, this is Jason Lank. You mentioned the term tracking error. When you invest in anything that's other than the market cap weighted traditional indices, you're going to get tracking error. The performance ride will be different. How do you view the education process so that people understand what they're actually getting?
Yeah, and from my perspective, it's just going back to the data. So, you know, if we take the earlier part of our conversation around value, right, and the different type of, you know, smart beta exposures that can actually target value. Well, if you look in 2018, you know, there's a handful of funds that would fall under the value category. Some of them had as little number of holdings as 20. Some of them had 1,322. So the 20-stock portfolio is likely going to have a high tracking error to the S&P 500 because you're taking on very concentrated bets. And if that's what you want as an investor, you want to get that, you know, ultra-pure type of exposure to value, then you have to sort of withstand some of that volatility relative to broad-based benchmarks because you look so different. And that if that was your goal, fantastic. If you wanted to just kind of sprinkle in a little bit of value premium but still maintain a sort of a tight relationship to broad-based benchmarks, well, that 1,300-stock portfolio is likely going to do that better than the 20-stock. But your exposure to value is going to be much different. So really understanding these different components of seemingly very similar strategies based on the name, by looking at the holdings, by looking at their expected tracking error risk, by looking at their underlying sector biases, can really paint a picture of, well, how different than the broad beta will this be?
All right, so that actually brings up another question. What about just the definition of factor? So the way State Street defines something like value might be different than how other fund companies define value. How does that fit into this process?
Again, I think it just goes back to the portfolio construction. So, for instance, you know, you have not only just the classification of what is value, like what metric do you use, whether it's, you know, price to book, which obviously come under a lot of attention recently, given the rise of intangibles. You know, price to earnings, price to cash flow, you know, enterprise value. As long as you have sort of, you know, a well-rounded approach to targeting the value exposure, and you can have it clearly explained of why this one might be the best, or if you use a blended approach, I think that gives a level of comfort. You know, there's obviously some people that, you know, like one representation of value to the other. I think as long as you're able to get exposure to that value factor in a very quantitative, rules-based way, you know, that could be beneficial to the portfolio construction process. You can explain, you know, why you're using this factor versus the other. The other one is then how you weight the securities. You know, are you going to, you know, weight them in a very highly concentrated format, or are you going to weight them, you know, where you have high capacity, so you're owning all the S&P 500 stocks just tilted towards value? In any of these conversations, it really requires you to go in-depth in the due diligence process and understand it as if you were doing due diligence on an active manager. And I think, you know, when we sort of think about our multi-factor strategies, we have that ability to talk about why we chose each one of these factor exposures and the reasons behind them, where we're not just throwing three factors together and saying, this was the best backtest.
Matt, you mentioned active managers. What should that due diligence process be between, let's say, an investor considering smart beta versus traditional active management? What should the decision-making be there?
So I think it still goes back to the four Ps of people, price, performance, and philosophy. So people, I think, obviously, is, you know, it's an index, so it's the index provider. You know, what do they provide in above just the benchmark themselves, so from a data perspective, but also the asset manager. You know, there's, for instance, like State Street, we have a long heritage of managing smart beta. We can go very deep, but we also go very very limited in our conversations to help the educational process. So I think that's important. And then obviously price, so transaction costs from a liquidity perspective to expense ratio, philosophy. Again, going back, so we have a three-factor strategy of min, vol, value, and quality. You know, what is the philosophy behind this? What is the goal and the outcome? And then performance, right? So, and I think this is where we're going to see the next leg of growth in a lot of these multi-factor smart beta strategies, you know, particularly in our own firm, is that these now have identifiable track records. So you mentioned QUS at the top. That just had its four-year number. Its sister funds, QEFA, QEMM, and QWLD, will hit their five-year number in June. So these have identifiable track records where you can see this performance in different market cycles, and you're no longer reliant on a back test. And I think that's going to be very additive for the future.
On the topic of performance for investors thinking about multi-factor ETFs, you know, we've been in this bull market where pretty much everything has underperformed the S&P 500, right, large cap stocks. And so some investors might be hesitant to consider factor-based strategies. What would be sort of your bottom line case here? Why consider multi-factor ETFs?
Well, one is just going back to what I said at the top, of that there's been these factors that have persisted over time that have been proven in academia. They're cyclical. By combining them, you're able to mitigate cyclicality while also targeting specific portfolio outcomes. That's sort of the basis or the foundation of the argument of why you should even consider it. The cynical person would say, well, these haven't been tested. Every back test is a great back test. And I would point to specific periods where the factor exposure showed its, you know, showed what the sort of fund manager told you would do. So if I think about going back to fourth quarter of 2018, massive sell-off, an exposure with a low volatility in it was able to mitigate some of that sell-off. Now, because, again, I will sort of use QUS as an example, because we were able to mitigate that sell-off, we outperformed broad-based benchmarks. Now, we also had a snapback rally coming in 2019. Low volatility trailed because it was sort of a risk-on rally. By combining value and quality, which are sort of return-seeking exposures, think about min-vol as one that's there purely to de-risk. Value and quality gives you upside. So what happened? QUS was able to have better upside capture to the market. So that's what I would point to, is these identifiable periods where you're able to showcase, like, okay, so, you know, we're telling you this is an equal blend of inexpensive firms that have healthy balance sheets wrapped within a low volatility strategy. Well, this is what it did in a period that was, you know, live and in real action to show how it might perform going forward if these type of volatility events or risk-on events continue to manifest themselves. So I just point to the track records. I think, again, we're at that sort of point in time where they're becoming lengthy and, you know, typical of a cycle, 3 to 5 year period.
All right, Matt, lastly, before we let you go, on a completely different note, I wanted to ask you about the fact that State Street has become much more aggressive recently in talking about ETF liquidity and sort of the total cost of ETF ownership. I'm just curious, why has this become such a focus now?
Yeah, I mean, for one part is we want to continue educating investors about ETFs, ETF liquidity, and also just how ETFs react during different market events. Coming out of Q4, we saw a lot of negative headlines about how, you know, potentially there's the rise of index investing, ETFs that exacerbated volatility, and that couldn't have been further from the truth, considering that, you know, ETFs mainly had inflows in aggregate in the fourth quarter, while the rest of the market was selling off. So we understood that, that there's an education need out there, and we thought we had, and we know we have, an adept strength and unique strength that really no other firm does, just given the presence of liquidity throughout our suite. So we also heard coming out of Q4 that we heard more questions about transaction costs and how liquidity was impacting the overall total cost of ownership. So given that, you know, we have a suite that trades 44% of all U.S. listed ETF volume, we're the liquidity leader in that space, and we wanted to be front and center in that conversation to make people aware of how, while expense ratios are really important, there's more to it in terms of costs. And understanding the dynamics of liquidity and how it can manifest itself in different periods, I think will be additive to the client experience when investing with ETFs. And we wanted to put that out there and to be, again, that thought leader and that educator, because, you know, we have the most liquid suite out of anybody.
Well, you had a great quote that I thought framed this perfectly. You said, sometimes you pay higher fees for lower costs. And I thought that was perfect, right? That if you're not looking beyond just the fund's expense ratio, and you're not looking at the bid-ask spread and the other costs that you're paying, you might end up paying more overall. So I thought that was really well said. Matt, we'll have to leave it there. Always enjoy having you on the show. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thank you.
That was Matt Bartolini, head of Spider America's research at State Street Global Advisors. And you can learn more about their entire ETF lineup by visiting spiders.com.